This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you again on this Saturday morning for another exciting program. Today, I decided, I was reading an article recently about gait and how we walk. And, you know, walking is such an important part of our daily function. And the article addressed the issue of, you know, we talk a lot about on this program getting your steps in, right? Your 10,000 steps or 7,000 steps, what are the appropriate number of steps? But what we never talk about is the quality of those steps and our posture and gait analysis. So with that, on today's program, we're going to be talking about gait, and we have two guests coming on. The first guest is going to be Dr. Christina Colon-Semenza. Dr. Colon-Semenza is a professor of kinesiology. She's an assistant professor of kinesiology at the University of Connecticut. She has a doctorate in rehabilitation and physical therapy, and she's going to talk about gait analysis. And it's something we should all be thinking about, especially as we get older. Why? And the reason is because often it's our gait and posture that predispose us to back pain, hip pain, ankle pain, knee pain. So if there's a way of analyzing our gait and changing our gait, that it's something we should look into. Then in the second half of our program, we're going to have Dr. Bernardo Rodriguez on the show. Many of you will know him. He's been on the show several times before. But he is a movement disorder specialist. And we want to talk about what he looks for in gait. Because a gait is often a key indicator of a neurologic problem, such as Parkinson's disease. We've talked about Parkinson's disease, but we haven't spent much time talking about how changes in gait and different things, like why, if Parkinson's patients get involved in a dance program, it helps delay the progression of their symptoms. But there are other things. There's peripheral neuropathy. There is myelopathy. There are other neurologic conditions that gait can be a precursor for and a hint for. So we want to talk with him about that. So looking forward to the program, especially the aspect of how do we prevent injury, because that's a big part of what we do on this program and the things we like to chat about. Now, one of the things you're hearing a lot about in the news is a rather well-known news person and personality, Wendy Williams. Apparently, there is a show coming on tonight and tomorrow talking about her life and the fact that she now suffers from frontotemporal dementia. So I thought it's worth chatting a little bit about that. The first thing they mentioned that, and I don't know any of this for a fact, not a patient, I don't have any inside information, I'm working on what we hear in the press. I've not seen the program, but I think that they raise interesting topics that we should be aware of for our own lives. So when we talk about primary progressive aphasia or aphasia in general, we're not talking about dementia. We're talking about a language disorder, of which there are three broad categories: agnosia, aphasia, and apraxia. Agnosia is the inability to recognize and identify objects or persons. All right, so sometimes a neurologist will say, well, can you name this object, like a pen, or what part of my pen is this, if it's the tip? So they have a hard time identifying these objects and identifying people they know. We've talked about this in the forest, something like prosopagnosia, where people have facial blindness. They can look at a face and not recognize that person. With aphasia, it's the impairment of the ability to use or understand language, of which there are two primary types. There is non-fluent aphasia, which is where people can't speak. And you see this a lot after someone has had a stroke that's affected their dominant hemisphere. So someone who's right-handed, it'll affect their left hemisphere, and they're unable to generate words. That's called a non-fluent aphasia, sometimes called a Broca's aphasia. So a lot of different terms for it. The other type of aphasia is the fluent aphasia, where someone can speak, but they don't understand the words they're using. So they often will use word substitutions, substitute one word for another that's not necessarily appropriate in that context. So those are people who have what they often call a Wernicke's or receptive aphasia, but the most effective dichotomy is regard to fluency and a fluent aphasia. And then there's apraxia. And this is a difficulty with motor planning. And these are people who are impaired in terms of being able to execute a voluntary movement. So being able to write. They'll look at a pen and not know how to do that. Or a gait apraxia, which we'll probably be talking later on with Dr. Rodriguez about, where someone essentially forgets how to walk. And we see that in certain conditions. So those are the broad categories of speech problem. Getting back to Ms. Williams, a primary progressive aphasia is often seen as an indication of a frontotemporal dementia. Now, frontotemporal dementia is different. It's not Alzheimer's disease. In fact, it comes on much earlier than Alzheimer's disease, usually between the ages of 40 and 65, most commonly seen in people in their 50s. And what you first start to see are personality changes, because it affects that area of the brain more anteriorly. So they become more socially inappropriate. They are impulsive and emotionally indifferent. So a lot of times these people, you know, end up with a psychiatric diagnosis. And people are thinking that they are schizophrenic or have some other psychiatric diagnosis or a behavioral problem. They certainly do, but it is related to a neurodegenerative problem, much like the other dementias. So again, this is a very sad situation. It's a very tough diagnosis to deal with. And I think what becomes more interesting is the fact that in the case of Ms. Williams, there were probably signs of it developing as she was in front of millions of people with a daily talk show. So with that, we wish her the best. And again, I hope that this gives people some indication when they hear these terms or if they watch this program, some scientific background to what we talk about. With that, we're going to take a short break. They're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Christina Colon-Semenza. She's assistant professor of kinesiology at the University of Connecticut. Today, we're talking about gait disorders. So if you have a question for me, feel free to get it on over at info@alessimd.com. I'll be happy to share that with today's guests. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to have as my first guest today, Dr. Christina Colon-Semenza. Dr. Colon-Semenza is an assistant professor of kinesiology. She has a PhD in rehab sciences, and we brought her on to talk a little bit about gait analysis. Christina, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me, Tony. Glad to be here.
So let's chat a little bit. What's involved in gait analysis when we use that term? What does it mean?
Yeah. Thank you for that question. And gait analysis really is part and parcel of what physical therapists do as a part of a comprehensive evaluation. But we can really think about gait analysis in two separate ways. There's instrumented gait analysis that's typically done in a scientific environment, in a laboratory that uses force plates. It uses motion sensor cameras, as well as looking at the kinematics and the kinetics of motion. And that's really done at a high level in a laboratory environment or in a specialized clinic. More typically, what you'll find in every corner physical therapy clinic is that individuals are engaging in observational gait analysis. And there are some formal standardized procedures to do that. Rancho Los Amigos has a standardized observational gait analysis system, which takes you through every phase of gait. And through that, we know what is the range of motion that's appropriate at that phase of gait. How much time should you spend in each of those phases of gait and what that would look like? So that all of those things can be a part of a comprehensive gait analysis. But really, the second that you walk into any physical therapy clinic, your physical therapist is observing your gait to help uncover what are the problems that you're dealing with to get to the root cause of how they can help you.
So, and how would you apply that? So, you know, when we're talking about this, why would someone go in and have a gait analysis?
Right. So typically what would happen is that, so let's say, I know that you have been interested in understanding kind of issues that are common in middle-aged and older adults, like low back pain or lower extremity pain, knee pain, arthritic pain. And so when someone's going into a physical therapy evaluation for pain management or issues related to these things, the physical therapist is doing a comprehensive evaluation to say, okay, so your pain is localized, let's say, to your left knee, but I'm not just looking at your left knee. I'm looking at how you're moving overall. So the physical therapist will look at the cycles of your gait to help understand how is that left knee pain now affecting every other movement when you're walking around in your house or going for a walk in your community. Because the problem is that although you're offsetting maybe the weight bearing on that left knee to avoid pain, that might then be precipitating secondary problems and causing you to have, let's say, now plantar fasciitis on the bottom of your right foot because you're now having to put more weight on the right leg. So a physical therapist is using gait analysis to have a comprehensive plan in treating you. And it's not, you can absolutely go in and say, I want my gait analyzed. And actually, physical therapists are trying to promote that everyone should have a regular assessment by a PT, because we know that walking, and particularly walking speed as a component of gait analysis, is being purported to be the sixth vital sign, that looking just alone at walking speed as a component of gait analysis can be predictive of morbidity, mortality, quality of life down the road for individuals. So yeah, looking at gait overall is just really important for overall health and wellness.
Suppose we take the other tact. So someone who has chronic back pain, chronic knee pain on and off and is a walker, can you correct that back and knee pain? And I'm not saying if it's something structural. Obviously, you know, if they have a torn meniscus or an ACL, that's not going to be the case. But if sure. Someone who has, you know, the typical kind of aches and pains when they get up late, early in the morning, do you think some of those aches and pains are caused by a change in their gait, especially if they're a walker? An article I looked at recently talked about how you needed to really look at the quality of your steps as opposed to just the number of your steps.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yes. And so often what can happen is, let's say somebody was dealing with an acute issue of low back pain or acute issue of arthritic pain in their knee. And, you know, the body will take the pathway to avoid that pain and alter the mechanics of their gait to deal with that pain, relieve that pain. And so what can sometimes happen is, even once the original precipitating causal factor for that change in gait is removed, unfortunately, the abnormalities in the gait might persist and cause these other problems. So, yes, a physical therapist can go in and say, oh, I see, you know, a few months ago you were dealing with this low back pain issue, and now you have shortened tissues in the right side of your body because you were trying to lean away from the pain. that really we can get rid of those and should restore you to a more symmetrical gait pattern and prevent additional problems further down the road from that asymmetrical gait that is persisting, even though the pain itself is now eliminated.
Looking towards an older population, one of the things we fear the most are falls, right? As we get older, tendencies to lose balance or trip and not be able to recover quick enough. Is that also part of the gait analysis? Because obviously there are some people, so many people are resistant to using an assistive device, right?
I have this
all the time with patients who say, you know, I have trouble when I'm walking long distance. I start having trouble with balance. The answer is a cane. So is that another thing that can be addressed as part of the gait analysis? And I guess I'm thinking more in terms of safety and preventing a more serious injury.
Yes, great question. And yes, we deal with this all the time, the stigma that comes along with assistive devices, but really in the face of a situation where falls can be really life-altering, right, and tragic. So how do we avoid those? We had some pretty robust tests and measures, thankfully to a lot of our foundational research, that gives us some really easy clinical tools to help measure both characteristics of gait and of balance to be able to predict who is going to fall. And we have some pretty, again, simple and easy ways to strengthen balance, either through strengthening exercises or balance retraining exercises that can reduce your risk of falls when you are at that high risk. And as I referred to earlier, gait speed or walking speed is one of those really powerful predictors. We know that individuals who are walking slower than 1.0 meters per second are at a really higher increased risk of walking. So that's someone who we're going to wave that flag and say, I'm so glad that you're here. I can tell you with a lot of confidence that you're at high risk for falls. Let's get you into therapy now. We can do walking training. We can do balance training. We can give you some exercises and reduce those risks of falls and keep you walking. We want to keep you walking. We know that maintaining your walking and your physical activity is key for your health and wellness, but let's make sure we can do that while still keeping you safe and free from falls. So absolutely, there are ways that we can evaluate risk for falls and look at that comprehensively in terms of balance and their physical activity and their walking.
Does insurance pay for this? If someone wanted to have a gait analysis, someone who's a walker, fairly healthy, but wants it, does insurance usually pay for it? I don't know if you know that or not.
Yes. So, you know, it's complicated. We, through the American Physical Therapy Association, are lobbying pretty hard to be a part of a comprehensive annual wellness exam, the Medicare wellness exam. We are currently not funded through that mechanism, but we are trying to be a part of that because we believe that everybody should be seeing their physical therapist at least once a year. But in the interim where we don't have that financially covered, there are clinics that will offer either a cash base where you can pay for an annual wellness exam, or some clinics offer a free annual wellness exam. But if you are having a problem, so if you're having pain with walking, if you're feeling off balance, most certainly that is covered by Medicare as well as private insurance. Absolutely, 100%. So that if you're, and if you're just saying, you know what, I feel off balance, that is justification enough to have a physical therapy evaluation and treatment. So likely most individuals, you know, can find a reason that is then justified for coverage for a physical therapy evaluation and treatment.
Christina, thank you for your time today. This has been very helpful.
You are so welcome.
I really want to encourage people to really think of that as part of their regular health, especially people who are active, who are out there walking regularly or running regularly, but dealing with aches and pains, worth seeing a physical therapist and really getting that analysis. Christina, thanks again for your time today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with our next guest, Dr. Bernardo Rodriguez. We're going to be talking more a little bit about gait analysis and how it impacts neurologic care. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Welcome back to Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and in the second half of our program, we're going to be chatting with my guest, Dr. Bernardo Rodriguez. We did have a quick question that came in from Bob, and that was how much would it cost if you had to pay out of pocket for a gait analysis with a physical therapist? And I did pose that question to Dr. Colon Semenza, and apparently it's highly variable. It could be $100 and could be $250 to have it done, depending on how they do it. In the article I read, they said it was typically about $100 if you went out of pocket. But what I would say is that if you already have an established physical therapist who you've used regularly, and that's usually the case if you've had orthopedic surgery, you tend to go back to the same therapist where you have built up a relationship, I would recommend contacting them to see about that, because often it's something they're willing to do if you're a regular patient. So, Bob, thank you for that question. As I mentioned, our next guest is Dr. Bernardo Rodriguez. He's an associate professor of neurology at the University of Connecticut. He specializes in movement disorders and is a good friend of mine and a good friend of the show. Bernardo, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Tony. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for the invitation. I mean, I'm in great company. If you just talk to Christina, she's so smart and so nice. So I'm happy to contribute to the conversation.
Well, it was very funny. The funny aside, I called her before the show in order to just go over things. And she said, well, have you ever spoken to Dr. Bernardo Rodriguez? I said, well, he's the next guest after you. So I know you've worked with her before. But let's get right into it. Gait disorders. What are they from a neurologic standpoint? What falls into that broad category of gait disorders?
So that's a great question, but also a very complicated question. You know, so all we know is that gait disorder is very common and is very complex. The reason why it's complex is because it affects a bunch of systems that the brain is responsible for, including stance, including balance, including postural reflexes. So the brain has to compute all of these information that are coming from these different sensors. And these different sensors include vision, hearing, the sensation in your joints, the sensation on the ground. You know, so the brain has to calculate how strong you are and how to challenge all of the terrain that you have to navigate. Sometimes you walk great on a flat floor, but when you go walk on a lawn, it's more difficult. Sometimes it's the opposite. Sometimes it's easier for you to walk on your grass than it is navigating obstacles. So it's a very complicated thing, and many neurological diseases will affect how your brain reacts to these challenges.
So let's talk about it from your standpoint. When you have a patient in the room as part of your standard examination, and probably more so from your examination of a patient with a movement disorder, what are you looking for when you ask someone to walk down the hall?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. And it all depends on the story, right? So it all starts with the story, what the patient is feeling and what the family is observing. You know, so a big part of our visit is like, tell me why you have trouble walking. And sometimes it's a funny question because they're like, I don't know. That's the reason why I'm here. You should know why I'm not walking well. But the important part is to listen to, like, what is it that you feel? Do you feel pain? Do you feel weak? Do you feel tired? Do you feel off balance? Is your vision good? So all of these things will take into place. But specifically answering your question, I'm a movement disorder specialist, and a big part of what I do is dealing with Parkinson's disease patients and also ataxia patients. So I will be looking at their posture. I will be looking at how long is their stride, how long is their steps, how narrow is the base, the separation between their feet, but also the cadence, you know, are they fascinating? Are they shuffling? Is this a magnetic gait? So there are so many different types of walking, and we tested all of those. We test how they do on a Romberg test. You know this very well, but it's a test that we ask them to close their eyes and check their balance. We do almost like a full sobriety test. You know, we check coordination, we check strength. So there is a bunch of things that we check, and it's mostly specific to the disease that we're shopping for.
So let's talk about some specific diseases. And I guess I want to get into one of the more striking gait disorders, that which is seen in normal pressure hydrocephalus. I think we're hearing more and more about that in terms of a diagnosis, in terms of imaging and things like that. Can you talk a little bit about normal pressure hydrocephalus and the gait apraxia that goes with it?
Yeah, so normal pressure hydrocephalus, it's very rare, but enough to cause disruption to the patient's quality of life, mood, and even safety. So we do have a team at UConn, and we have a specialized normal pressure hydrocephalus clinic led by Dr. Neha Prakash, that they check gait balance, they check gait challenge. And the specific about normal pressure hydrocephalus is that it's at the core of the disease to have gait changes. The gait changes, the apraxia, like you described, is called as a magnetic gait. So when people walk or when they try to walk, they feel like their feet are stuck to the ground, like magnets to the ground. So they have like small steps, they're very wide base. And typically when we look them walking on camera, and we typically we do these exams on camera, we see their arm swings are going crazy, but their legs are not moving. And that really leads to loss of balance, you know, and it's really hard for them to recover from a loss of balance. So when they lose balance, their feet are stuck to the ground, so they just fall. So magnetic gait is the most commonly described change in patients with normal pressure hydrocephalus. Sometimes they will have some shuffling gait, which is something that we see mostly with Parkinson's disease patients. And that's why it's important for you to see a specialist, to see a neurologist, so they can separate, you know, is this early sign of Parkinson's disease, or is this something more compatible with normal pressure hydrocephalus?
What a great description, because I've never heard it described that way, that their arms are moving and their feet aren't. And it really brings together that visual. Now, I don't want to leave the topic because we see a lot of people now referred. So if someone has a CT scan for some incidental issue, a headache or something else, often we're getting reports back consistent with normal pressure hydrocephalus in terms of the size of the ventricles. Can you talk about the other factors in that triad so that people are a little bit more aware when they're referred to us and they see that in their my chart, what is normal pressure hydrocephalus and the fact that so many people are referred to us for it and don't have it?
Right. It's great. And that's why we had to put together a whole team to assess this. So in our comprehensive normal pressure hydrocephalus clinic, we have a neurologist who is going to examine you, record the exam on camera. We have a rehabilitation team that will, again, check how fast you walk, how far you can walk, how good is your balance on camera before and after testing. We have a neurosurgeon who is going to do the spinal tap and the treatment necessary for the normal pressure hydrocephalus. And we have a radiologist that will also review. So we sit down around the table. So it's not an easy diagnosis. The core symptoms of normal pressure hydrocephalus, clinical symptoms, are changes in memory, changes in balance. That's what we're talking about right now. And bladder changes. When you find these on the patient, they have cognitive changes, balance changes, and bladder changes. That's when you obtain a scan. And the scan will specifically show that these natural holes that people have in their brains called ventricles, they will be enlarged, full of water, hydro. They will be hydro brain, hydrocephalus. So hydrocephalus is just enlargement of these water spaces. And if the team assess you, and if you have a great assessment, there is a treatment for normal pressure hydrocephalus, which is draining that fluid out, you know, typically with a shunt.
So It's always good to hear about something that's treatable when we hear about cognitive problems and gait problems. Let's move on to another one. When people have a myelopathy, so they have compression of their spinal cord, what does their gait look like to you when they come to you?
So it will depend on the location of the spinal cord compression, because you know this very well. The spinal cord is a bunch of wires that will travel from your brain to your legs. And it will connect your brain to your legs and will send a bunch of information. If this information that is being affected is a sensory information, you will have a sensory ataxia. If the information that is being cut in the spinal cord is a motor, a fiber, then you're going to have weakness, and then we call a hemiplegic walk or a spastic walk. The most common problem that you see in spinal cord is going to be a spastic gait. Your muscles will just get super stiff, and they will not stretch as much, and your legs is going to start crossing in front of the other. There are so many descriptions of neurological gaits and posture, and in this case, we call it scissoring, because the legs will start crossing one in front of the other, and to the point that they actually hit each other, they get stuck. And the treatment that we typically talk about for spasticity is going to involve some kind of muscle relaxant, most commonly like botulinotoxin injections.
When we look at peripheral neuropathy, so you already mentioned the importance of the fact that there are so many neurologic factors and pathways that go into proper gait. But, you know, peripheral neuropathy is a little bit different because, as opposed to myelopathy, right, we're losing sensation in our feet. Can you talk a little bit about that and the dangers of that with respect to falling?
I think that the danger of neuropathy is the fact that it's so common. It's so common, it's so frequent, that it's almost normalized. You know, people come to the clinic and they tell me, hey, I have neuropathy, no big deal. No, it's a big deal. It's the most common cause of gait disorder. It's most common cause of falls. So having neuropathy is extremely deleterious for your balance, because when you lose these sensation fibers, when you lose these wires that bring sensation to your brain, you lose a notion of what is that your feet is doing, what is that the ground is doing. So you want to feel the ground, but you also want to feel your muscles, you want to feel your knees. So neuropathy is pretty important. It's very common, commonly associated with diabetes, commonly associated with aging, and commonly associated with alcohol exposure.
When let's move right on to Parkinson's disease, which is something you have the most experience with. When we talk about a Parkinsonian gait, you already touched on some of the features of it. Can you go into it a little bit more in depth? For example, is that sometimes the first symptom you see in Parkinson's disease?
A lot of time it is. You know, sometimes the tip of the iceberg is the tremor. You know, so when people see the tremor is the tip of the iceberg. But the gait is a very common one. A very common story that I hear in the clinic is I was walking and then my daughter thought I had a stroke because I wasn't swinging my arms. So that's one of the most common features in Parkinson's disease is going to be gait changes. And it starts with decreased movements, decreased arm swing, decreased step size, so shuffling gait, small steps, and people will start to walk slower and slower. So Parkinson's disease is famous to cause tremor, stiffness, slow movements, including slow walking, and postural changes, posture and balance changes. So when we look and assess for a patient with Parkinson's disease, it's a big part of the exam to look at them standing, look at them walking, see if they move their arms or not, see how far is their step, how fast are they moving, and stuff like that. Just to compare with normal pressure hydrocephalus, normal pressure hydrocephalus has a lot of arm swing and no leg movement. In Parkinson's disease, one of the key features will be decreased arm swings. They are stuck to the ground, and that really throws them off balance. because you use your arms as counterbalance, you know. Next time you walk, pay attention how your arms oppose your legs, you know, to keep you in good balance.
Let's talk about some of the treatments. You already talked about with normal pressure hydrocephalus, you drain some of that spinal fluid. And I'm assuming in the case of myelopathy, if there's something compressing the spinal cord, you can remove that and retrain the gait. Am I correct in that in terms of retraining after the surgery?
Absolutely correct. I think that the best success that we have had has been with a combination of our physiatry teams, our rehab teams, and our medications. You know, so it's a little bit of both. It's identifying how far one can help the other. I think rehab is at the center of the assessment of gait, but also at the treatment. They can provide a 1-2 punch. You know, they can see what is wrong with you, and they can institute the intervention right away. Same with physiatry or physical medicine and rehabilitation. They will be able to use orthotics. They will be able to indicate the botulinotoxin injections, stretching exercises specifically. In my case, I'm a neurologist, right? So I will treat specifically diseases. And also, like we talked about, spasticity, the treatment of choice will be botulinotoxin injections. For Parkinson's disease, is a disease that people have deficiency in dopamine. So when we give them dopamine, they walk 100% better. They're faster, their posture improves, their energy levels improve, they're able to walk much more steady.
Let's, you know, since we're talking about Parkinson's disease, maybe you can give me some insight into this. I mean, we know that many studies have been done that people who have Parkinson's disease who engage in dancing, specifically Latin dancing, will be able to improve their mobility. We've heard about that with Parkinson's patients who are involved in boxing programs. How does that work, Bernardo? I mean, how are they retraining to do that? That's almost like the hyperkinesis that you can see sometimes with Parkinson's disease or something of that nature. But how does that work?
So you're correct. You're absolutely correct. We have non-sport ages that exercise is good for the brain. And I'm not talking only about Parkinson's disease. I'm talking about dementia. I'm talking about healthy aging. So exercise in general makes your brain healthier. It makes your brain regrow neurons, which is something unheard of up to this moment. And there are so many programs, you know, some of them very well known to the community, like the Big and Loud, the Silver Sneaker, Rocksteady, Beat PD Today, and even Parking Pong, you know, so ping pong improves. So we have known since 2005 that dancing tango, Argentinian tango, improves gait and balance in Parkinson's disease. And it seems to be, Tony, a combination of the beat, you know, the rhythmic auditory stimulation, you know, having that cue that will lead the patient to take the step at the appropriate time. Dancing is phenomenal because it's a social event, you know, it's a fun event. So it involves motivation, involves mood. But specifically to the pathophysiology, we're talking about giving the brain cues so they can execute. Is also a very safe environment, right? So you typically dance with a partner, so there is that trust, that safety. You don't hesitate. You feel a little bit more comfortable. But specifically to dancing in Argentina tango, they have some challenging postures. You know, there are some back walking backwards and turns and twists that really puts you to the challenge. So that started with the Argentinian tango, but we now think it's a class benefit. So there have been studies on waltz and foxtrot too, and even Tai Chi, which is part dance, part martial art, have shown. It's difficult to know exactly what, but there is a lot of balance training, there is a lot of resistance training, and there is a lot of cardio involved in these dancing sessions, you know, so it seems to be a very complete exercise program for people with Parkinson's disease and neurological diseases.
Bernardo, thank you. Thank you for your time today and giving us some insight into gait disorders. and all your work with our patients with Parkinson's disease and other movement disorders. Thank you, Bernardo.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you for having me here. This is such an important topic. It affects quality of life. It affects independence. You know, if you fall, if you break a bone, if you break your hip, you know, it's such a negative impact in your healthy status. But thank you for discussing this important topic.
Thank you. Thank you again. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I want to thank my guests today, Dr. Christina Colon-Semenza, as well as Dr. Bernardo Rodriguez. Many thanks to our studio producer. Kevin Kors has been on the board, and Jeff Chandler is in charge of sales and marketing, as always, for Healthy Rounds. Next week, we're going to have a taped program, actually, for the next several weeks, but they will have new intros. And I'm bringing back some of the interviews that have been the most popular. So so if you had missed them or didn't get them on the podcast, you'll be able to hear those again. As mentioned, if you missed any part of today's program, you can get it on the Healthy Rounds podcast that could be downloaded free from Audacy.com, Apple.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rachford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.